Well, another Christmas is around the corner. This is Jerry Newcomb on Vocal Point, and we're going to be talking with Bill Federer. I should note this is a pre-recorded interview because of our schedules. Bill, welcome to the program. Bill Federer.
Jerry, great to be with you.
You have written so many books, and one of them is called There Really Is a Santa Claus. Tell us about that book.
Well, St. Nicholas is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. And he was a real person. He lived in Asia Minor, which is today Turkey. But the story is that he was imprisoned under Diocletian, the Roman emperor. He was let out by Constantine, who was the one who legalized Christianity in the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
St. Nicholas then went to, matter of fact, tore down the temple to Diana. He preached against it. So Ephesus nearby was the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean, and people would go on pilgrimage. They'd go on a religious pilgrimage to the Temple of Diana. Unfortunately, it had 127 huge pillars. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, but it was filled with temple prostitutes. So,
wow.
So it's sort of like the Las Vegas, and he preached against it.
And by the way, we should just stop you. When we read our book, The Ephesians, here is Paul writing his epistle to the Ephesian Christians, and they're in that kind of Las Vegas-type context. Most people don't realize that. That's interesting. Go on.
And then he was there at the Council of Nicaea, and that is what the tradition is, that when Arius was sharing his Arian heresy, that Nicholas was so upset that he slapped him across the face. So jolly old St. Nick had a little temper.
Let's stop you right there. Arius was a man who was a presbyter. He was from Alexandria in Egypt, and he believed that Jesus was God, but is, with a small g, a created God. His views are best represented today by the Jehovah's Witnesses, but thankfully the Trinitarian view, which is what we find in the Bible, that won out in the Nicene Council. But I didn't realize that about St. Nick actually hitting the guy. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, Arius had made his doctrine, but either he or somebody had turned it into a little song, and it was a catchy song, and so people would sing this song. And the fascinating story of Nicholas, and of course, the most popular part is how he was generous, gave to the poor. And the story is that, matter of fact, let me just start from the beginning here a little bit, but
sure.
It was 280 AD is when he was born, and this was about 22 years prior to the end of the persecution of Diocletian. Diocletian was the last Roman emperor, and he had lost some battles with Persia, and he asked his generals why, and his general said, "You've neglected the Roman gods." So Diocletian orders his army to worship the Roman gods. Well, it had been several years since the last persecution. There were 10 major persecutions of Christians in those first 300 years. Anyway,
why do you say he was the last Roman emperor?
The last Roman emperor to persecute Christians.
Oh, okay, okay.
And so it was about a 30-year persecution. And so he orders his military to worship the Roman gods. The Christians that were in the military said, "Look, we're loyal to you, but we cannot worship these pagan gods." They're forced out. Once the Christian conscience is out of the military, Diocletian used the military to force all of Rome to worship the Roman gods and started this terrible persecution of Christians where he tore down churches, burned scriptures, cut out their tongues, boiled them alive, and went province by province, systematically arresting church leaders and killing them. And anyway, just sort of a reflection of today, the fallout effect of promoting homosexuality in the military is that the good old boys are taking early retirement, getting out while they can. The new, the Christian families are not going to want to send their kids to the military to get, homosexualized by some gay sergeant. And we now have our first homosexual general in the Army Reserves. And so we're going to see a de-Christianizing effect of our military. And then the question is, once the Christian conscience is out of our military, what is what's the president going to do with them? And then we're reminded of very recent history of how the atheistic government in China used their military to kill 80 million of their own people. The atheistic government in the Soviet Union used their military to kill an estimated 60 million with all the different purges. And then an atheistic military in Cambodia under Pol Pot killed several million in their killing fields. And the same thing in Ho Chi Minh and Vietnam and Castro in Cuba and Ceausescu in Romania. And so we see horrible things can happen once a military has lost its conscience that everybody is sacred because they're made in the image of God, and it just turns into, hey, whatever the emperor tells me to do, I do.
Well, okay, but now let's get back to the ancient Roman Empire, and specifically St. Nicholas.
So anyway, the story is, and again, he's the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. There are more Greek Orthodox churches named after St. Nicholas than anybody else. Sort of like in the Coptic church, there are more St. Mark churches named. Anyway, the story is that his parents had died when he was a young teenager, or in his teens, and so he inherited a large amount of wealth, and he was generous with this wealth. That he had an uncle who was in the ministry, and so he encouraged Nicholas to use the wealth that the Lord had given him to help people. And he wanted to do it anonymously, so he would give money to the poor, but didn't want them to find out about it. Well, there was a story of a merchant in the town, the town of Patara, Asia Minor, and the merchant went bankrupt. And the creditors back then would not only take your house and lands, they would take your children.
Oh.
And so the children were three daughters. And so the story is that Nicholas heard the problem, and the father's desire was to hurry up and marry his daughters off, and that way the creditors couldn't take him. But he did not have money for a dowry, which was needed for a legally recognized wedding. So Nicholas heard the problem, and late one night threw some money in the window. Supposedly it landed in a shoe or a stocking that was drying by the fireplace, and it provided the money for the oldest daughter to get married. And then he did it for the second daughter. And when he threw the money in the window one night for the third daughter, the father ran outside and caught him. And Nicholas made him promise not to tell where the money came from, wanting the glory to go to God. And so this started the tradition of secret gift giving on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, which was December 6th in 343 A.D. And it was just a localized Greek practice. And then until the Muslims invaded and they moved his bones to Italy.
All right, and let me just stop you right now. This is Bill Federer we're talking about, and we're talking about how in the Christian tradition, myths that surrounded the real person, St. Nicholas, developed into Santa Claus, and that Santa Claus, although sometimes upstaging Jesus Christ, and some people don't even realize, the Christian connection to Santa Claus, but those connections are extremely strong and important to underscore. Santa Claus is a part of Christmas, obviously, as we celebrate it. And the fact of the matter is it gets back to Jesus Christ and the spirit of Jesus Christ. And this giving, this anonymous giving, Jesus said, when you give, don't let the left hand know what the right hand's doing. Don't do it in such a way that people will see and then glorify you. Instead, do it in such a way that people will glorify your Father who is in heaven. And St. Nicholas obviously practiced that in his own life.
And he did have a fascinating life. Now, the stories the Greek church has passed down are very involved and detailed. So, for example, one story is that there was a corrupt governor, and he was about to kill some soldiers, blaming them for some problem. And Nicholas heard about it and showed up at the execution and stopped the executioner's hand, and then began to read the governor the Riot Act, and by the Holy Spirit, saying all the stuff that he had done with nobody knew about, and the governor realized that this was God that was telling all this, and so he gets on his knees and he begs Nicholas to pray for him that God would forgive him. And
you mean Nicholas, by some sort of revelation from God, knew what the governor himself had been guilty of, and he made that public in that context, and the man repented.
Right, that's one of the stories.
And obviously kept the execution from happening. Yeah, okay, one of the stories from the Greek tradition. All right, go on.
Another is that there was a famine in the land, and the people get Nicholas to go down to the port, and he talks some of the sailors who are taking grain from shipping grain from North Africa, and they're shipping it to Europe, and Nicholas talks the sailors into unloading some of the grain to help his people, and the sailors said, "Well, we can't, you know, do this," and Nicholas promises them that God will bless them and will multiply the grain that's left in their ship. And on their return trip, they said, sure enough, that's what happened, and they showed up with more than enough grain in their ship. And then one of the stories was there was a storm, and it was so terrible that the fishermen and sailors could not get back into port. The city where he was at, Myra, was a port city. And so Nicholas goes down and prays, and the sea becomes calm, sort of like Jesus calming the sea. And there's lots of stories like that, and some of them are more believable than others, but they fill the Greek traditions. He dies in 343 A.D. He was so popular that the Byzantine Roman Emperor, Justinian, builds a big cathedral outside of Constantinople, names it for St. Nicholas, and he is just a locally honored saint until something happens in the year 1087. The Muslims begin to invade the Byzantine Empire, matter of fact, just another story that I can insert just a century before, 988 A.D., Vladimir the Great, the Emperor of Russia, decides to convert to Greek Orthodox Christianity, and he adopts Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. It's actually the first chronicle of Russia. Vladimir was the founder of the Russian Empire, and he decides to adopt a monotheistic faith, and when the Muslims find out about it, they send ambassadors to Vladimir. And he listens to them, but then when they get to the part where, when they talk about paradise being filled full of women, they said, Vladimir listened intently because he was fond of women. But when it got to the part where they could no longer drink alcohol, Vladimir stopped them, and he said, "We cannot have this because drink is the joy of the Russes, the Russians." So it's sort of funny that Russia did not convert to Islam because Vladimir liked to drink. But the Roman Catholics sent ambassadors to Vladimir, and he did not accept their proposal. The Jews sent ambassadors to Vladimir, and he goes, "Let's see, you offended God, and he kicked you out of your homeland, and so now why again should I follow you?" You know, and but then the Greeks sent ambassadors. Now, the largest church in the world was in Constantinople, 160 feet high dome, 102 foot across,
Hagia Sophia,
4 acres of gold mosaics, Hagia Sophia.
Yeah.
And so, and they spoke Greek. The language.
By the way, can I just stop you for one sec? For anybody who have seen the movie that's still in the theaters as of this taping, Argo, there's a shot in that movie of Hagia Sophia. Of course, the Muslims took over in Constantinople, 1453, killed a lot of people. But converted that into a mosque and I guess eventually into a museum. But you see this shot with Jesus Christ, and yet there's all these Muslims around. That is Hagia Sophia. I didn't realize it was the most beautiful or the biggest church ever built, you said, at the time?
Yeah, it was. There was no Vatican at the time. I mean, this was right. The church in all of
it's
Christendom.
Huge. Okay.
And, so anyway, when they show up to Vladimir, and they spoke Greek, the language of the New Testament, he's convinced and he converts. And so that's why the Greek Orthodox Church became the Church of Russia. And just about every city in Russia had a church named St. Nicholas. And, you know, their czars were named Nicholas and Nikolai.
Oh, yeah.
But then the Muslims invade. And the Byzantine emperor cries to the West.
You don't mean they invade Russia. You mean they invade Constantinople, right?
Right, right.
The Byzantine.
Now, they did invade Russia. They actually captured Moscow, the different golden hordes and so forth, but that was at a later date. They did invade what is today Turkey, but back then it was the Greek Christian Byzantine Empire. All mm-hmm. seven churches mentioned in the Book of Revelation were there. They were all wiped out by the Muslims. The Byzantine Emperor cries to the West for help. The West eventually sends help. It's called the Crusades. But when they first started invading, the Muslims would turn churches into mosques, dig up the bones of the Christian saints and give them to the dogs. And so the most popular Greek saint was Saint Nicholas. And as they were getting close to the church where his bones were. There were some Venetian merchants that decided to take his bones over to Italy. And they moved his bones in the year 1087 to Bari, Italy, B-A-R-I, Bari, Italy. And there's a cathedral there to this day with the bones of St. Nicholas.
Wow.
Matter of fact, the Muslims sued around the year 2000 to get the bones back so they could have them there in Turkey for a tourist attraction. Thankfully, they weren't sent. But anyway, 1087, Nicholas is introduced to Western Europe, and the gift-giving associated with his death on December 6th, anonymously, became popular, and it spread, and it became so popular that St. Francis of Assisi, sort of in protest, came up with the nativity scene, the creche scene, saying, look, all this gift-giving is fine, but we need to get back to the reason for the season. Jesus was born in a manger, and so the Jesus, Mary, Joseph, donkey in a manger, that came from St. Francis of Assisi. But it continues to spread into Germany. And when the Reformation started with Martin Luther in 1517, he ended the saints' days. Every day of the year was named after, you know, named for a specific saint, and
sure,
they would have days honoring them. But Luther ended those, but the people liked gift-giving. And so it was Martin Luther that moved the gift-giving from December 6th to December 25th and said that all the gifts come from Christ. And so the gifts come from the Christ child. So they would say on Christmas Eve, the Christkindle's coming, the Christkindle, which means the Christ child. Of course, over the years, Christkindle got pronounced Kris Kringle. So Kris Kringle was not young Santa Claus. It was Christ child. And that was Martin Luther's. Now, Martin Luther also was walking home one evening and saw the stars twinkling, and so he's the one who took the tree and put candles in the branches and told his children this was like the sky above Bethlehem on the night of Christ's birth. In England, they had a little different twist to it. They had a Reformation. Henry VIII wanted another wife, ended up having six wives. The English church ended the saints' days, including the popular St. Nicholas Day. And what Henry VIII did was sort of bring back an old Roman holiday. You have to remember that Britain was a Roman colony. And the Romans for a while had Saturnalia, sort of at the end of the year. They had their feasting and merriment, and Saturn was their god of gift-giving. And if you remember the Christmas Carol with Charles Dickens, there's the spirit of Christmas present. And it's this big, fat guy with green robes, a wreath in his hair, a goblet of wine, you know, grapes all around, sort of the ho-ho happy party guy. And you're asking yourself, who is this guy? He sort of looks like Santa Claus, but he also sort of looks like a Roman god.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was Saturn. But he was Christianized, and they called him Father Christmas. They could not call him Saint Nicholas because saints were outlawed. Mm-hmm. And so you saw in England there was this sort of a mix. And
Wait, can you stop? If saints were outlawed, how is it that in the King James Bible, which was produced obviously in England...
Well, the saints' days, the days honoring the saints.
Okay, because, I mean, the gospel according to St. Matthew, according to St. Mark...
churches named, you know, St. Michael's and so forth. But as far as the days honoring them, the emphasis was taken off of...
All right, and let me just...
the saints and honoring the saints, and it was moved to... December 20th.
All right, before you continue about England, I want to say this is Bill Federer. Bill Federer is a great author and speaker, and one of his many, many books is There Really Is a Santa Claus. And it's filled with all kinds of facts, like some of these things that he's bringing to light. AmericanMinute.com is the way you can reach Bill Federer and learn more about his great books. All right, go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, and so the title of this book is There Really Is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So during the time of Henry VIII, Christmas in England became sort of a Mardi Gras. You know, Mardi Gras is actually originated as a religious day.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was the day before Lent when you would fast 40 days before Easter, but it turned into this lewd party in New Orleans.
Very degraded.
That's sort of what happened with Christmas in England during Henry VIII. That it turned into this drinking, partying, carousing, visiting, you know, it was a big party time. And so there were the Puritans in England, and they did not think the king should be over the church, and they didn't think that the church of England separated enough from the Catholic Church, you know, kept the cassocks and things. But these Puritans objected to this party time at Christmas. And so that's when they actually eventually had a civil war in England, and the Puritans won, and they outlawed Christmas.
Yeah, now wait. It's not like they had a civil war over Christmas. It's they had a civil war over Parliament, whether Parliament was allowed to meet or not, et cetera. I mean, there were a lot. Religion was definitely a motivating factor in that civil war, a huge motivating factor, probably the catalyst issue, but obviously it wasn't like it was a fight over Christmas. But go ahead.
No, and so we see the Reverend John Cotton, right? He's a Puritan in Massachusetts, and he says, "Can you in your conscience think that our Holy Savior is honored by mad mirth and by long eating and hard drinking and by lewd gaming, by rude revelry, a mass fit for none but a Saturn or a Bacchus or a night of Muhammad and Ramadan? You cannot possibly think so." He goes on to say that that you should... A multitude of heavenly hosts was heard praising God, but shall it be said that the birth of the Savior, for which we owe as high praises to God as they can do, that we take time to please the hellish legions and do actions that have as much more to do with hell than heaven? Anyway, that was the attitude of the Puritans.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you look at it today, Bill. I mean, if you have like a debauched Christmas party, how is Jesus Christ honored by that? He's not, but go on.
Well, and it's interesting that the pilgrims, they were separatists. They left England. They came to the New World, and they didn't celebrate Christmas. Matter of fact, the master of the Mayflower was the captain of the ship. His name was Christopher Jones, and he writes in his ship's log. He says, December 25th, 1620, he says, at anchor in Plymouth Harbor, Christmas Day, but not observed by these colonists, they being opposed to all saints' days, etc. A large party went ashore this morning to fell timber and begin building. They began to erect their first house, about 20 feet square for their common use to receive them and their goods. So the pilgrims did not celebrate Christmas. They were of the view that the Sabbath is the Lord's Day, and every day is holy. Anyway, William Bradford, writes his History of the Plymouth Settlement, 1621. He says, "Herewith I shall end this year, except to recall one more incident rather amusing than serious. On Christmas Day, the governor called the people out to work as usual. Most of the new company excused themselves." So this was a second boatload of pilgrims that came over. "Most of this new company excused themselves and said it went against their consciences to work on that day. So the governor told them if they made it a matter of conscience, he would spare them till they were better informed." So he went with the rest and left them, but upon returning from work at noon, he found them at play in the street, some pitching the bar and some at stool ball and such like sports. So he went to them and took away their games and told them that it was against his conscience that they should play while others work. So we see that he says, if they made keeping the day a matter of devotion, let them remain in their houses, but there shall be no gaming and reveling in the streets. So pilgrims and the Puritans did not really celebrate Christmas.
Okay, wait,
the Germans came over.
Wait, well, now we have about 5 minutes left, and there's still some loose ends here. Okay, obviously the pilgrims and the Puritans pushed back because of the pagan overtones to the way it was being celebrated. In the meantime, when it comes to
Saint Nicholas,
getting back to Saint Nicholas, how do you go from the saint that you described earlier to the fat guy, who climbs down the chimneys and so forth?
Well, it was
short
the Dutch
version.
That settled New Amsterdam.
Okay,
and the Dutch
New York
had Saint Nicholas, and the Dutch pronounced Saint Nicholas Sant Niklaus or Santa Claus. And they built a church. It was the largest Protestant church in North America. It was a big, beautiful St. Nicholas church in downtown New York. Mm. Unfortunately, in the last century, had attendance go down, and they sold it to some oil company who tore it down and built a big building, skyscraper. But over the years, the biblical stories were a little bit twisted. So the story is that Jesus would return at the end of the world to judge the living and the and the saints would come back with Jesus to judge the living, right? And they would be riding white horses. And so in Holland, St. Nicholas would come riding a white horse from Spain, dressed as a bishop, to sort of do a little mini checkup, a little mini judgment. And so the angels would have the Lamb's Book of Life and the Book of Works, and you'd be judged out of that. Well, it turned into the Book of the Naughty and the Nice, and the angels turned into the elves. And then the celestial city, you know, where is the saints and Jesus going to come riding on their white horses from? The celestial city, the New Jerusalem. Well, that turned into the North Pole. And so we began to see these biblical stories began to get a little bit far off. And when they landed in New York, the Dutch had their St. Nicholas traditions, the Sant Nicolaas. And there was a writer in New York named Washington Irving. And he's the one who wrote Rip Van Winkle and Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And he sort of fictionalized history. Well, he wrote Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York from the beginning of the Dutch settlement to the end of the Dutch dynasty. And he writes about how St. Nicholas would visit them once a year, dropping presents down the chimneys to his favorites and then riding off on a wagon over the treetops. But he described St. Nicholas, still called him St. Nicholas, but described him no longer wearing the bishop's outfit, which he wore in Holland, but instead wearing the typical Dutch outfit, long trunk hose, leather belt, boots, and a stocking hat. And then the next ingredient was in New York. It was the Clement Moore was a Hebrew professor. He was an Anglican, and he wrote A Visit from St. Nicholas, a poem for his children. Yeah. And he still calls St. Nicholas, but he describes him as a right jolly old elf. I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A broad little mouth and a round little belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly.
So for the first time, Santa Claus became fat. Through
fat and small.
Clement Moore.
Now he's shrunk in size and a tiny reindeer.
And then there's the cartoonist Thomas Nast, who did
Thomas
a lot of...
Thomas Nast gave us the Republican elephant, the Democrat mule, and he is the one who put a North Pole sign behind a picture of St. Nicholas. And this was considered a political jab at the South to say St. Nicholas associated with the North. And so he's now in the North Pole rather than the...
And then we jump to the 20th century and we find Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola kind of perfected,
mass marketing. They had Haddon Sundblom, who is the artist, every year for 30 years would do a painting of Santa Claus drinking Coca-Cola. But now he's full grown again. He's no longer the little elf size.
Right.
He's got ruddy cheeks, rosy complexion, a nice huggable grandfather look. And that was the image that was spread around the world, and it stuck.
That's amazing. All right, and more details.
People that it all started with the real guy who was a saint, who loved Jesus, who was imprisoned under Diocletian, who tore down, you know, helped tear down pagan temples and and was generous, gave to the poor.
Isn't that amazing? So And we need to remember this.
Santa Claus.
I mean, it's like no Santa Claus, no Jesus Christ, or no Jesus Christ, no Santa Claus. We need to remember that. We have about maybe a minute left. Can you explain the 12 days of Christmas? I understand, for example, in the West, we celebrate December 25th as Christmas Day. In the East, they celebrate instead a date in January. January 6th. And you change those. Which is the day of the wise men coming, and they couldn't come up with a compromise, so they finally did come up with one compromise, which is the 12 days of Christmas. Those are the
tours in 567 A.D., and so they decided to make all 12 days from December 25th to January 6th the 12 days of Christmas.
This is all Christian. So, this is all a Christian thing.
Right, so it's not the 12 days leading up to Christmas, it's the 12 days between December 25th and January 6th.
Right.
The 12 days of Christmas.
But people don't realize, I mean, when you see these, all these Christmas trees, or you see ornaments on the Christmas tree, which represents the world, you know, for God so loved the world, that's why all those ornaments are round, they represent the earth. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. All these different Christmas traditions, even the ones that seem very pagan, really, ultimately, almost all of them get back to Jesus Christ. And Bill, I thank you so much for writing that book. I used it about a year ago for a speech I gave, and it was extremely well received. That book is tremendous. There is a Santa Claus. Of course, all your books are great, and people can visit Bill at AmericanMinute.com. Bill Federer, all the best to you, and let me be the first to wish you Merry Christmas 2012.
Merry Christmas to you, Jerry, and all the listeners.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye.